Well, where we left things last week in Joshua 2, Israel were only just about to invade the land of Canaan. Things have moved on, of course, by chapter 9, and because the Lord fights for them, Israel is now known as an unstoppable war machine. And by now they've chalked up two major military victories. The great fortress cities of Jericho and Ai both now lie in smoking ruins. And of course, now all the nations around are quivering in their boots. The fall of the impregnable Jericho was one thing, but now Ai is gone too. So they've got to do something. So verses 1 and 2. Now when all the kings west of the Jordan heard about these things, on to verse 2, they came together to make war against Joshua and Israel. Well, of course, at one level we can understand them. They're under heavy fire. The best defense is to fight back. But when it comes down to it, actually we're left thinking, why bother? Have they not seen the relentless power of the God of Israel? Well, that was exactly what went through the minds of the people of Gibeon. They knew that the Lord had spoken a word of doom against all the inhabitants of the land. Back in Deuteronomy 7, the Lord had said through Moses that when he gave the nations of Canaan to Israel, he said, then you must destroy them totally, make no treaty with them, show them no mercy. And knowing that there is no way to beat the Lord, the people of Gibeon decide that fighting Israel ain't the answer. And this is a matter of life or death. So they decide to rebel against their king, the king of the Hivites, and they decide to take matters into their own hands. So verse 4, they resorted to a ruse. Turn over to verse 4. In fact, if we translate that little phrase just a bit more literally, we see there is something odd going down. For literally, verse 4 says, they also resorted to a ruse. They also? Now who else had pulled a fast one? Could it be they resorted to a ruse like Rahab? Rahab had lied to the authorities in Jericho. I mean, is being wily just something that runs in the Canaanite blood? Well, certainly the Gibeonites are quite like Rahab. Or could it be they resort to a ruse like Joshua? I mean, Joshua had been distinctly sneaky in the way he'd gone about destroying Ai. You can read about that in chapter 8. Well, our narrator has some more puzzlers to put to us, so we'll just put that one on hold for now. They also resorted to a ruse. But for now, we mustn't look down too much on these Gibeonites for being so underhand. After all, it seems they knew the Lord's instructions from Deuteronomy 20 to Israel. The Lord said, all the cities that are at a distance from you, Israel, make its people an offer of peace. However, in the cities of Canaan, do not leave alive anything that breathes. Well, what else could the Gibeonites do? They had no alternative. They couldn't openly make peace with Israel. No treaty would be accepted. So they must try to get a treaty signed with Israel on the basis that Israel thinks they're not on their hit list. It's their only shot. Their only hope. Now, every man, of course, has got a pair of revolting old shoes, you won't chuck. So they get all those together for a delegation, and they stop by Gibeon Grammar, pick up some sandwiches that have already gone off, and they set off as representatives of a nation from miles away. And look at our food and clothes. Proof. Verse 6. They went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the men of Israel, we have come from a distant country. Make a treaty with us. And there's our next teaser. Why are we told that all this happens specifically at Gilgal? Gilgal. Now that's the place where Joshua had made sure that all the men of Israel had been circumcised.
Why meet there?
And then it all becomes clear in verse 7. Verse 7. The Gibeonites are part of the Hivites. Now, here's where all our puzzles are answered. Now, this is an old story from the days of Jacob and his sons, hundreds of years before, back in Genesis 34. And what had happened was that even back then, the Hivites had wanted to join Israel. And the sons of Israel, Levi in particular, had deceived them. So they'd said, well, you can join us if you get circumcised. Fair dues. Every Israelite man needs to get circumcised. If you want to join us, all your men must be circumcised. But when the Hivite men were recovering from the operation, and so hardly at full fighting strength, the sons of Israel went through the town and killed all the Hivite men. So the Hivites had been terribly deceived by the sons of Israel. And now they also resorted to a ruse. So we have to admire their stickability. Here they are again. They come to Gilgal, the place where you get circumcised, and they ask again to join Israel. And with their past dealings with Israel in mind, it's hardly surprising. It's no wonder they want to keep their cards close to their chest. You have to be sneaky to deal with this lot. So, we've come from a distant country, they say. Make a treaty with us. And if Israel swallowed that, then there's no reason why they shouldn't link up. Israel had always been a multinational congregation. And just look back at Joshua 8, verse 33, page 233. Joshua 8, verse 33, where Israel is said to consist of aliens and citizens alike. But the scam very nearly fails. As in verse 7, the Israelites think they might smell a rat in these dirty backpackers. They can smell something pretty nasty anyway. Are you really from a long way away? They ask. Oh yeah, the Gibeonites reply. Miles away. Verse 9. We are your servants and we've come from a very distant country because of the fame of the Lord your God. We've heard reports of him, all that he did in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan. Now notice that even though it's the devastation of nearby Jericho and Ai that actually motivated them back in verse 3, they're obviously not going to mention them. Don't let the conversation get too close to home. But what a lot they know. They know that it is by his name that the Lord saves. And they reckon it is the case that even lands very far away have heard of the great events of the Exodus. And just like Rahab, they would rather defy their king than be on the wrong side of this God. Well, the Israelites don't check this with the Lord. After all, why would they need to? It all seems to add up. Of course, it's clear that they're quite rusty on Canaanite geography. But then the spies sent to do the military mapping of the land had spent all their time in Rahab's brothel, so that's hardly surprising. And after all, these guys, they looked like they were from miles away. The sandwiches were revolting, and what were obviously once the latest designer sandals were now very much last season's colour. They had to be British. Well, certainly not from nearby. But what do you think would have happened if in verse 14 they had inquired of the Lord? What would have happened? Do you really think that the Lord would have said, oh yeah, nice try by Gibeon to join my people, but no, wipe them out? Of course he wouldn't. In fact, in chapter 11, he specifically commends the Gibeonites as the one people who did respond correctly to him. All the peoples in Canaan had heard just the same things about the Lord, and where Gibeon chose to join with him, the kings opted to fight him. And that is still how Jesus divides the world today. The same sun softens wax and hardens clay. Now, if they had consulted the Lord, he would surely have given instructions to give them a warm welcome, because he shows such favor to them later. In just the next chapter, those Canaanite kings, they want to make an example of treacherous Gibeon and destroy them. But the Lord protects Gibeon and provides the greatest miracle in the book of Joshua for Gibeon. The sun stands still for a whole day for Gibeon. And then the tabernacle, the place to go to meet with the Lord, is housed in Gibeon. So greatly is Gibeon honored. And years later, when King Saul has a fit of pure racism and decides to try to wipe the Gibeonites from out of Israel, the Lord sends a 3-year famine as a punishment. You can read about that in 1 Samuel 21. So far from being excluded, so greatly is their zeal to be a part of God's people honored that they are accepted into the very heart of Israel's life, with Gibeonites taking some of the top jobs in the land in King David's day. So verse 15, the Gibeonites got what they came for. Joshua made a treaty of peace with them to let them live, and the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath. But 3 days later, the Israelites discover that they had been royally had. And where the Lord may be happy with the deal, the people are most definitely not. They can't go back on an oath in the Lord's name. What's that going to look like to the surrounding nations? But surely these cheats ought to have some comeuppance. So verse 21. They can live, but they must be servants to the people. Well, Joshua is a little wiser than that. Yes, they should have an active role to play in the community of God's people. But actually, there's a more important issue at stake. The reason the Lord had commanded there to be no interactions with Canaanites was because there were some very pretty Canaanite girls. And some of the Israelites might be sorely tempted to clinch a deal with future father-in-law by conceding to have just one little idol stashed under the bed. So Joshua ensures these new members of Israel get well and truly stuck into the worship of the Lord. In fact, that's going to be their daily job. Verse 23, you can serve as woodcutters and water carriers for the house of my God. If you are to be a part of the people of God, you must utterly abandon all other gods, all idolatry, and worship the Lord by serving him in his house. It's not much of a curse, is it? Especially when that house of the Lord is kept in your hometown. And to be a carpenter is to be a profession that later will be greatly honored. And the psalmist could write that the desire of all those who fear the Lord is always, I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. And given that it was Levi that had tricked the Hivites back in Genesis 34, it's quite appropriate that the Hivites get to join in so much of Levi's work now, serving in the tabernacle. So from then on, the Gibeonites have always been a wonderful, visible token of the Lord's promise to bring nations from all over the world to worship him. And with the Gibeonites around, nobody could ever imagine that being saved is about who you are related to. And now, for us, what a challenge the Gibeonites are still. Rather than shouting for terms of peace over the ramparts of their city, they prepared early for the coming judgment, and they fled to take shelter in the only place possible, under the protection of the Lord with the people of the Lord. And to do that, they had to do what many today still have to do. They had to defy their king and countrymen. They knew that they faced a matter of life or death, and so do we. As with them, we have little choice. We will either join with the people of God or we will be destroyed. So real did they know the coming judgment to be that they took desperate measures to escape it. And so real is the judgment that very soon will come upon the whole earth when the same Lord wipes from it all wickedness, that we too should be just as prepared to take just such desperate measures, even to find king and country, to be sheltered from the wrath of the Lord. The great Bible scholar Matthew Henry, writing at the beginning of the 18th century, said, "Let us imitate these Gibeonites and make our peace with God so that our wickedness shall not be our ruin. Let us be servants to Jesus, our blessed Joshua, and make a league with him and the people of God, and then we shall live." Let's pray. Great Lord of Israel, thank you for the zeal of these Gibeonites to be a part of your people. Would you give us their all-consuming desire to avoid your judgment and to serve you? And would you have us be so clear in our proclamation of your coming wrath that we see whole nations again flocking to join with your people? Amen.